You are listening to the Health Hack Podcast, powered by Lumen and hosted by myself, Caroline Pierce. As an athlete, sports scientist, and sports presenter, I am passionate about health and how we can unlock the skills to hack our full potential. Each episode, I'll be joined by a leader in the health and well-being world to learn how they've come to understand their body and turned that knowledge into power that could help you too. My guest today is a true pioneer of women's health. She's a nurse practitioner, nutritionist, TED speaker, and the author of Intermittent Fasting Transformation, a book that I cannot wait to discuss. Please welcome Cynthia Thurlow to the show. Cynthia, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thank you. I've been looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, do you know what? Me too, because intermittent fasting, of which you are an expert in and your book is all about, if people are watching the video, we can see it there in the background, is something I have been doing intermittently, I must admit, for some time. And I had so many questions. I've been reading your book and I think we can learn so much from all the extra benefits. I think a lot of people won't realize. But just first off, please do give us a little bit more about your background and how you found your way to this area of expertise, because I understand it was sort of through your own personal experience that you came across intermittent fasting.
Absolutely. And I'm a traditional allopathic trained nurse and nurse practitioner. So all of my clinical experience is in ER medicine and cardiology. And as a nurse practitioner, I worked in clinical cardiology for 16 years. And I started probably 10 years into working in medicine, I started to question a lot of what we were telling our patients about lifestyle changes. And unfortunately, in our current medical model, we really don't have the amount of time to spend with our patients talking about sleep and nutrition and, you know, eating less often. And so, you know, as I became a mom and as I started to, you know, see patterns with my patients, we could control symptoms. We weren't really addressing root cause issues. I started to question a lot of what I'd been taught. And I really came to intermittent fasting out of a desire to fully understand and appreciate what was going on with my body. I speak very openly about the fact that I never struggled with weight loss resistance, not after pregnancies, not during my 20s or 30s. And then in my early 40s, things changed. I think the intensity of my exercise combined with a very stressful job and a husband that did a lot of international travel and having two small kids probably was more stress than what my body could manage at this time of reverse puberty, this perimenopausal period, which for many women is 10 to 15 years prior to going through menopause. And I hit a wall and I'm so frustrated because all the things I used to do were no longer effective. And so I came to intermittent fasting out of a genuine desire to see if it would help me reverse my weight loss resistance, which it did. But it also gave me a profound understanding of how incredibly impactful this strategy can be, not just for women, but also for men. Mm. And so I then started talking about it with anyone and anyone who was willing to, you know, take an interest in it. And I didn't then realize that it would then be a strategy that I would be known for, but it's one I'm very passionate about. And I always like to remind people that, you know, these kinds of lifestyle changes that are designed to be sustainable long-term changes are the ones that can really put us back on the right track with our health. And so as a nurse practitioner, I was wonderfully humbled by the fact that something as simple as eating less often could be so impactful on our hormones, on our sleep quality, on just better, you know, better energy levels. I mean, all these things that we take for granted and we assume are a byproduct of the aging process, that, oh, it's because I'm X age, that's why I don't have energy. No, it's very likely that there's some type of lifestyle component that is making things harder for you to achieve your goals.
So we don't have to accept what seems like the fate of, like you say, you're going to have less energy, your body, everything's going to start aging, et cetera. I like that. And it sounds so simple. And we're going to all the benefits. I really want to dive into those. But you then did a TED speech. How long ago was that? Because it went viral, didn't it? And what resonated with people so much for this to be, you know, like you say, it became what you're known for?
Yeah, no. So I'm an introvert. And so in 2018, I decided that doing a TED talk would be a good challenge. And so I did one on perimenopause, the super sexy topic of perimenopause. Yeah. And around the time that I did my first talk, I was offered a second. And so that's the one that you are alluding to. And I think on a lot of levels, I picked a topic I knew a lot about. And I truly believe that the message was very simple, concise. It's actually very hard to do a shorter TED Talk. My first TED Talk was 18 minutes. My second was 12. You would think it would be easier to talk longer. It's actually harder to be concise and succinct and do a shorter talk. And I think there were many things that were at play. you know, I had been very seriously ill and left the hospital only 27 days before that talk. And part of why I wanted to do that talk was to show my kids I was okay. So that was number one. So there was pure intent when I did that talk. I really just wanted my kids to see that I was okay. And number two, it just coincidentally ended up being one of the most Googled search terms or terminology in 2019. And so the talk within the first 24 hours had 90,000 views, within the first week had 1 million views, and it's just continued to grow. And I think it has a lot to do with a very simple, concise message and one that a lot of people can relate to. You know, intermittent fasting is not new or novel. I think for a lot of people, it's part of their religion. Like I was raised Roman Catholic and fasting was part of High Holy Days and it's part of all the major religions. And so I like to remind people that we wouldn't be here as a species if we couldn't eat less frequently. So I think there's many reasons why the talk did so well, but obviously it's lightning in a bottle. There's a lot of things I can't explain. And I always tell people, I think every person who does a particular talk, they genuinely want it to do well, respectably well. But this is certainly a very unique situation and one I'm profoundly grateful for because it changed my life and my family's life forever.
Yeah, it's incredible. And before we go into that, one thing we do on the Health Hack Podcast is I just do a few quick fire questions at you, just so people can get a little bit more about you as a person and your habits. And then we get into our discussion. So I'll just kick us off. And first thing that comes to mind, but the funny thing is the first question, I know what your answer will be. And the first question I always ask people is, do you eat first or exercise first in the morning? And I'm assuming you don't eat first thing in the morning.
No, I don't. I enjoy exercising in a fasted state because to me, it's just you do one before the other. That's just works well. I'm an early bird. But yeah, absolutely exercise first thing.
I thought so. What's your number one way to boost your metabolism?
I think there's a combination of things. I would say prioritize protein. I think that's very, very important. On a lot of different levels. For those of us that are north of 40, we know that we start to accelerate losing muscle and replacing it with fat. So I think protein is number one, it's super satiating. Number two, it breaks down into amino acids that help preserve muscle function. And, you know, to me, unfortunately, I mean, I can only speak from the United States, but I know here people tend to prioritize carbohydrates and the wrong types of fats. And so I think protein being the most satiating macronutrient will shut off those appetite cues and can help you sustain healthy lean muscle, which helps with insulin sensitivity. So that would probably be my first suggestion.
Yeah, fantastic. What's your go-to dish for a quick healthy meal?
Interestingly enough, I did this in my IG stories last night. We eat a lot of ground bison and a lot of ground beef. And so last night I had ground bison literally with homemade guacamole on top. And so it was protein and some healthy fats, super easy, sprinkled it with some Redmond salt. And it was totally nourishing and totally, for me, perfect macros. So that's a really easy thing to do. I tell everyone all the time, I have teenage boys, so we probably cook 4 or 5 pounds of ground meat at a time because my teenagers eat so much food. But that's a really easy thing. And if you do dairy and you tolerate cheese, like raw, you know, cheddar, or you like tomatoes on top or maybe olives, I mean, you could make a taco salad essentially from that. But we've actually created a taco seasoning in my house. And so last night, my husband cooked that up and it was just a super easy, clean meal to eat that, you know, keeps your blood sugar stable, helps to, you know, fuel your body in a good way.
I'll have to try that. You know, I've obviously had guacamole and I haven't actually had bison, but
really
beef. I'd have to give that a try. What's your key to getting a good night's sleep?
Oh, I think you have to think about sleep when you get up in the morning. And I tell people that, you know, when you get sunlight exposure on your retinas within your eyes in the morning, helps suppress melatonin. It helps increase cortisol and get your day started. I think there's many things that I think about. I think about hydration. I think about not eating too close to bedtime. So if you look at the research in circadian biology, it's really important not to eat within 3 to 4 hours before bed. Obviously, it's all individual. So there are some people listening that probably can get away with that, like my teenagers do. I think you have to sleep in a cold, dark room. And our thermostat's 65 degrees at night. I sleep with an eye mask. I have a whole slew of things that I do before bed, but really prioritizing and thinking about sleep when you get up in the morning is certainly very important. Another thing that's really easy that people can do, whether you take a hot bath or take a quick shower, raising your internal body temperature will also help you kind of make that transition to healthy sleep. There's certainly supplements that I'm happy to share, but those are the things that I do consistently, irrespective of where I am, to really help with sleep. And I think the other piece that I neglected to add was exercise. I don't care if you just walk before, right after a meal or right before you go to bed, just making sure you're moving your body throughout the day is certainly very beneficial.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what's your personal biggest motivator to living a healthy life?
Oh, gosh. I think because I saw what happens to people when they don't take care of their health. I mean, obviously, I've been a clinician for over 25 years, and I certainly had a lot of patients that had fantastic quality of life in their 70s, 80s, and beyond. And I saw just as many who had a really poor quality of life. So I think those memories of the patients, what they were doing, the ones that had a really great quality of life. And quite honestly, I want to be able to keep up with my kids. They're now teenagers. They're going off to college in a few years. I want to be able to have fun with my grandchildren. I want to be able to travel. And, you know, I actually genuinely enjoy the time I spend with my husband. And so wanting to make sure that we have a high quality of life and can continue traveling, exercising, doing all the fun things. I think a lot of people forget that the habits that we start in our 20s, 30s, and 40s have tremendous impact on how our lives are in our 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. And so for me, a lot of my focus is ensuring that I will be healthy and able-bodied to be able to enjoy my family throughout my lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes sense. Thank you. Let's get on to the conversation about intermittent fasting. And as I say, I've got your book here as well. I've been absolutely glued to it. But I think the most obvious question first for people listening is, what is intermittent fasting? And I'm sure you get asked that question a gazillion times. And how does it differ to other forms of fasting, which are probably more severe or difficult for most people to actually do? You know, think of fasting, and we just think, oh my God, that sounds awful. And it sounds something that I couldn't possibly do.
Yeah, no, it's a great question and certainly an important one. So if we're defining what intermittent fasting is, it's eating less often. And for many people, it's really deciding that there's a time to eat during your day and a time to not eat. And the differentiator between intermittent fasting and prolonged fasting is duration of time. So when someone is intermittent fasting, they may choose to not eat for 14, 16, 18, or 20 hours during a day. And during that time is when our body does a lot of really amazing and wonderful things. I like to remind people that if they are not familiar with fasting or intermittent fasting, that you spend most of that time sleeping. You know, I think there's this misnomer that there's association that fasting equals starvation. And I remind people, it is very different. We are still eating. We're just eating within a compressed feeding window. So it might be that someone eats within an 8-hour feeding window and they have two good sized meals. And what I find for many people is they then get connected to their hunger cues. They then get connected to what it feels like to have periods of digestive rest. And if you listen to the current methodology, a lot of the dogma that many of us were raised with is that we were conditioned to believe we had to eat every 2 to 3 hours to stoke our metabolism, that breakfast was the most important meal of the day, and that we should eat a lot of heart-healthy grains. And I'm the first person to say that a lot of that information has contributed to escalating rates of obesity and metabolic disease. So intermittent fasting is certainly aligned with ancestral health perspectives, meaning the way that our bodies were designed to thrive through periods of food feasting and periods of famine, when there was not access to food and our body would go in and then break down stored energy as a fuel source. So it's not new or novel, and it's certainly a really healthy way to get your bodies better aligned, better balanced. And I would say in most instances, unless I have specific things in the book as to people who should not be fasting, but most adults can safely fast. And I encourage people, if you're on medications or you have chronic health issues, have a conversation with your provider. The wonderful thing is more and more healthcare providers are becoming familiarized with the strategy and they're supporting it. So it's definitely one that I think most people can benefit from.
I like what you said about the bad dogmas, because I have my master's degree in nutrition. And back in the early 2000s, I was studying nutrition. And it was very much that, you know, you need to break the fast as soon as you wake up. You need to keep stoking the fire by continuously giving yourself little bits of food, little and often. I was an athlete as well, to continually have that available energy. And this idea that if you went prolonged periods of time without food, you'd just store fat. Your body would then store the fat. So for a very long time, I both preached this and did this. And I think I got my body very used to wanting food often, not really liking big meals or anything like that, but eating often. And so when the sort of like conversation, like you say, it's not a new thing, but the idea of intermittent fasting sort of came back into my sort of, you know, thought process or what I was reading, I immediately thought, I can't do that. I love my breakfast. I get up for breakfast. It's what gets me out of bed. Like, I go to bed looking forward to my breakfast. So for me, when I did try to do it, I found it really hard. And I found that I was rushing my workout in the morning, so I just wanted to be able to get to my breakfast. I was not taking on any challenging tasks in the morning because I was like, well, I can't till 12 o'clock till I've had my breakfast. I found it really difficult. So I actually did lose weight and felt very lean, but it wasn't a pleasant thing for me. And I realized because now I do it mostly, you know, I've come back to it and I've realized that I was just so metabolically inflexible to, you know, I trained myself for so many years to need that fuel. It was going to take a while for my body to adapt. And now I do eat quite late. That's probably one of my problems, but I will hold off eating until sort of 12 o'clock after my training, et cetera. I just have caffeine, et cetera. So would you say that I'm a classic example there of how a lot of people might find the experience because we're so used to that ready available food and being conditioned to eat often? And I was feeling physical hunger pains when I wasn't in the morning.
Yeah, well, I think there's many things to say here. Our bodies get acclimated to habits and our bodies sometimes don't like change because it makes us uncomfortable. Mm. And so I think a lot of what you're alluding to is your body was accustomed to eating at a certain time so that those hunger growls and, you know, the discomfort that you felt could very well have been dehydration, which I remind people, our stomachs will growl in response to dehydration way before it'll start growling in response to food. I'm not suggesting anyone starve themselves. And I think an important distinction about young women is to mention that there are times in our cycle when we should fast and there are times we should not. So you may have picked, let's say you picked during your luteal phase, which is the time period preceding your menstrual cycle. It could explain why you're really struggling. It might very well have been, yes, you were primarily using carbs as a fuel source and your body wasn't metabolically efficient. Could have been exacerbated by the time during your cycle that you chose to start fasting. So I think that's an important distinction. And you strike me as a fairly lean young woman. And so I also think lean people have to fast differently than people who have a lot of metabolic inflexibility and have a lot of weight to lose. And so there's a couple things that could certainly be at play, but what we're really speaking to is metabolic inflexibility. That's the bulk of the population, not just the United States, but most westernized countries, that this constant desire to eat, the chronic hunger cycles, that is a direct interrelationship with not giving our bodies the proper types of fuel. And so always being protein focused, right types of fats, which are not seed oils. And I'm not sure if these are used as substantially as they are in the United States, it's almost, if you look at packaged processed foods, it's almost
terrible.
And if you look at the research on seed oils are bad on their own, but each time they get reheated, they actually increase your likelihood of developing insulin resistance and oxidative stress and, you know, all the way down to the mitochondria, which are in our cells. And so, you know, that combined with the wrong types of carbs. And I think everyone that's listening has celebrations and times in your life when you have a piece of cake or you have ice cream. I'm not saying don't enjoy celebrations and not enjoy having an occasional treat. But if the bulk of your diet is processed carbs, French fries, fried foods, et cetera, as opposed to eating low glycemic berries, non-starchy vegetables, et cetera, then you're setting yourself up for worsening issues related to insulin resistance and metabolic health issues. And so what I find for a lot of people is depending on who you are and who the individual is, it may take a couple weeks or longer to start becoming fat adapted, to your body starting to utilize either carbohydrates or stored fat as a fuel source. And even lean people have plenty of stored fat. It is not something that's just unique to people that are obese or overweight. And I think that's really important that all of us have plenty of stored fat. We store, you know, fat, obviously we want it subcutaneous fat is preferred as opposed to deep visceral fat. But the point I'm trying to make is that we can train our bodies slowly over time to be able to tap into those stored fats for energy. And that's when people will report things like tremendous mental clarity, lots of energy, you know, feeling like they don't even think about the food piece because they'll eventually get hungry and they'll fuel their bodies, but it's not the first thing they think about. Like you mentioned, when you woke up in the morning, the first thing you were thinking about was, you know, eating, you're breaking your fast and eating your breakfast. And so there's a tremendous amount of value in allowing you to live a life not focused on when the next meal is, because I certainly was part of that group of clinicians that was telling my patients snacks and mini meals. And essentially what that's doing is it's contributing to more hormonal dysregulation and why it's so important to encourage people to, you know, not eat as frequently, that is better for insulin. It's better for blood sugar response. It's better for so many reasons. But I'm glad that you got to a point where you were able to enjoy and integrate intermittent fasting into your lifestyle.
Yeah. And you know what? Doing it the second time around, if you like, and like, I don't do it every day. And I'll ask you about that as well. But I almost feel like my mornings have been freed up now because I'm not going through this whole process of my smoothie making. I love my smoothie. I now just have it later in the day. But, you know, I can get straight on with whether it's a bit of fresh air, whether it's, you know, just getting straight onto some work or whatever, you know, whatever my routine might be. But I'm saving myself a lot of time in the morning. But I think we just have, and you said it, that we have this emotional and habitual association with food. We're not very intuitively eating anymore, you know, and I think this is a great way to get us into that zone. And I ask a lot of guests on this podcast, you know, what they think about intermittent fasting, you know, guests that might be experts in other things. And, you know, most people see the benefits. Some say it's for some people, not for others, etc. But to speak to someone that's truly, you know, trained and experienced in this is a real treat for me. And I think what a lot of people might be asking, well, what are these other benefits? And I know you touched on energy, weight loss, even though that wasn't what you were directly seeking. Same with me. I got leaner, even though that wasn't what I was necessarily seeking. But I'd love to go through a few of them in a little bit more detail. The first one being metabolism and obviously linking to weight loss or fat loss more specifically. How does intermittent fasting or sort of shortening that window of eating contribute to boosting our metabolism? Because we're we are the Health Hack podcast sponsored by Loom, and we talk a lot about metabolism. So that would be my sort of first point of interest, if you like. How will it help with our metabolism?
Yeah, well, you know, something that's important for people to understand, there's a hormone that's not a bad hormone, but it's unfortunately, it's been characterized as a bad hormone. There's a hormone called insulin. And so insulin is a hormone that when it's low, it allows your body to free up stored fat, break them down into fatty acids, and then they can be used as a fuel source. There's also a fourth macronutrient, which are ketones, which when they are broken down, they can actually diffuse across the blood-brain barrier, which helps with that mental clarity and energy. But back to insulin, when we're eating constantly, when we're eating snacks and mini meals, insulin every time in response to our blood sugar goes up, our insulin goes up. And I remind people that if we have two meals a day and that's the only time insulin is evoked, you're going to have more opportunities to tap into those fat stores. That's going to help with metabolic flexibility. Whereas if you're eating three meals a day and snacks in between and drinking fructose laden soda or other types of products, which if you know nothing else about fructose, you don't want to drink fructose. It's terrible. It's stored as fat. It's plain and simple. But I think it's important for people to understand that when you're eating frequently, your body doesn't have the opportunity to look at utilizing stored fat as a fuel source. What it's doing, it's just, it's like literally taking a little skim off the top of the carbohydrate. And that's why you get hangry. And that's why you get hungry frequently, because it's not an efficient use of fuel.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important just to understand the bare bone basics. We want our body to be able to use both carbohydrates and fats as a fuel source. Only way to be able to really tap into using stored fat as a fuel source. And this is where people many times get the ketogenic diet wrong. They think they can eat all the fat in the world. And I always say, I'd rather burn the fat in my body then eat huge amounts of fat in my diet. Doesn't mean I don't like fat. I do. I just don't eat a lot of it. It's also much more calorically dense than carbohydrates or protein. But back to your original question, it's important for people to understand the way to master insulin is you have to eat less frequently. I mean, there's many things that contribute, but one of the ways that you can help with metabolic flexibility is to eat less frequently so that your body is able to go in and utilize stored fat as a fuel source. And it then has all this trickle-down effect of other benefits that you will derive from that. But I think that's the easiest way to explain that in a way that's very tangible for people. Eat less often, let insulin do its job, which means you secrete it less often. You're able to tap into the stored, you know, fat as a fuel source. That is going to be much more impactful than continuing on with the narrative of eating snacks and mini meals, which I think are actually contributing to a lot of the metabolic disease that we're seeing.
Yeah. And I'm guilty of being quite a snacker. And I do find even though I'm intermittent fasting, so my eating window's smaller, I'm still eating fairly frequently within that window, just that that window is shorter than it used to be. How frequently should we be eating? Say we're eating for 8 hours.
Yeah.
Can we afford to eat a little bit more often because we're fasting for longer? Or is there still a goal to maybe sort of just stick to more meals and less of that snacking in between?
I'm not a fan of snacking. I know what happens. You go on vacation, we're in a friend's house, that's different. Really and truly, if you look at research, if you look at the physiology of the gastrointestinal tract, there's something called the migrating motor complex that acts as a street sweeper in the gut. You really need 4 to 5 hours between meals. So if you're constant, let's say you have lunch at 12 and then you have a snack at 2 and then you have a snack at 4 and maybe you eat dinner at 8 o'clock at night, you really haven't given your body this opportunity to be able to move food efficiently through your digestive tract. Again, more frequent eating is going to impact insulin. And we talked about how that is designed to store, to free up fat if it's low, and it'll store fat if it's high. And so I think on a lot of levels, I always say, like, I'm a realist and I recognize we go on vacation, we have celebrations. But as a rule, if you're putting your macros together properly, if your first meal has protein, healthy fats, and the right types of carbohydrates, you shouldn't be hungry to necessitate a snack. I think snacking in many ways is a habit. It's just one of those things, like, I work from home and there are certainly days where maybe I'm bored, maybe I'm dehydrated. I might gravitate towards my pantry, but I remind myself, like, am I really hungry? Generally, I'm not. Yeah. I'm just bored. And so I think we have to think about, you know, I just ate before I came on the podcast. And so I had about 55 grams of protein. I'm not hungry. There'll be no snacking till my next meal, but I've been working at this for a long period of time. And so my kind of blanket response is usually, if you hit your protein macros, which should be no less than 30 to 50 grams of protein with each meal, then there should be no desire to snack. But I think a lot of snacking, myself included, is sometimes out of boredom. Maybe I'm dehydrated. Maybe I'm stressed. I mean, there's so many reasons we snack, but I would rather see someone eat 2 to 3 healthy meals in window than have a meal that doesn't have enough protein. Then you snack, then you eat another big meal. Yeah. Because if you think about what's happening physiologically in the body, and I think for a lot of people who are already lean, they don't see the utility in just eating, you know, big boluses of food. And I'm not suggesting anyone stuff themselves, but I think it's important to just be cognizant of our habits around snacking. Is it serving our best interests? And I think that's important to consider.
Yeah. So we talked about insulin there, and so your book's sort of aimed at women. And one thing that, again, it's probably a false information that I'd come to sort of understand, was that it can be more difficult for women to fast because we produce more of the hunger hormone. Is it the ghrelin in our body? Is that true or false? Because I found just, and this is just anecdotally from people I've spoke to, that most women do find it initially harder than, say, men do to go longer periods without food.
Well, I think there's a number of things. Our bodies, up until when we go 12 months without a menstrual cycle, are designed for procreation. Yeah. Even if you choose not to procreate, or you're done having children, or you're not ready to have children, our bodies are exquisitely sensitive to the input of food. And so this is why I always say you have to fast your menstrual cycle. If you're under the age of 35, there's 2 weeks out of your cycle that you can really get away with fasting. And if you're really lean, I probably wouldn't even encourage you to do it daily. It might be you do it a couple times a week. And then there's times in a woman's cycle, especially if she's under the age of 35, that she shouldn't fast the week preceding your menstrual cycle. So do I think it would be much harder for the average woman to try to fast 16 hours a week before her period, or 3 days before? Absolutely. And that is because if you think about physiologically what's happening in the body, how, you know, even if you're choosing not to have a child, your body is thinking the possibility of pregnancy is there, even if there has not been a fertilized egg. That's the way your body is thinking. So I think there's that point. I definitely think for perimenopausal women, again, 10 to 15. So if you're 35 or up, you're there. These are women that are going to be more sensitive to sleep deprivation. They're going to be more sensitive to the types of exercise that you're doing, sleep and stress management, not to mention anti-inflammatory nutrition. I find the women that do the best heading into menopause are the ones that start eliminating inflammatory foods. And that could look a little different for everyone, but I'll give you some examples. I start to think about alcohol, you know, women really examining their relationship with alcohol. We know it impacts brain health, it impacts REM and deep sleep, it impacts our food choices. It can put us at risk for certain types of cancers, including breast cancer. That's not to suggest having a glass of wine here and there is not a big deal. But how many women do I know that are in the past 2 years have been drinking more out of stress? You know, really looking at the type of exercise women are doing. If people are doing Orange Theory Fitness is a thing here in the States. It's not as intense, not as intense as CrossFit, but it's very intense and really, you know, examining what your exercise pattern is like. You know, people think they can get by in 4 to 5 hours of sleep. Guess what? You can't.
So you're saying the more intense exercise, sorry to interrupt, so the Orange Theory is a very intense, high interval training type of exercise. So you're saying that can be detrimental for women perimenopausal or, you know, at certain stages.
And it's not to suggest there are other people out there that do it successfully, sure, but they probably don't do it 5 days in a row. They might do it one day and then they may have recovery time in between. That doesn't mean that they're a couch potato. But I think a lot of women's perspectives, which also can contribute to your original question, people think a little exercise is good, more is better. If a little bit of fasting is good, more is better. If a little bit of food restriction is good, then more is better. And so I'm starting to see what I like, and I talked to Rob Wolf about this on my podcast recently, was that I'm starting to see a lot of women north of 35 that are over-exercising, over-fasting, over-restricting. And that can be detrimental to your hormones. So I think there's a lot that goes on with women. I think when we look at the statistics on obesity, insulin resistance, metabolic inflexibility, it's almost everyone. And therefore, to suggest that women somehow cannot fast, that it's somehow unhealthy, is really not looking at the big picture. And I really, truly, fervently believe that the power of the N of one, meaning each one of us as individuals have to determine what works best for us and our bodies. But 12 hours of digestive rest is not going to harm anyone. And that's what we should be doing as a bare bone basic. I was raised by an Italian mother. There was no snacking in my house. There was no sitting around watching a lot, you know, there wasn't a lot of watching TV or doing Atari, which is what we had back in the 80s. We just live very differently. And I'm so grateful that my mother served as a really great example of what to do. Because I think a lot of people are growing up now living very differently. And, you know, not realizing that those habits, maybe you can get away with it when you're younger. And as you get older, it can be problematic.
Yeah. So with women, it's more a little bit more personalizing the way you do it regarding cycle and all the rest of it. You know, I read as well, you talk about the benefits for gut health. You talk about the benefits for anti-aging. And the anti-aging thing, I think it's almost becoming as desirable as the weight loss industry, if you like. And this idea of it helping autophagy, so the sort of cell renewal process as well, which I've always been very interested in as well. Again, you get over 35 and suddenly, right, anti-aging's as important to me as losing weight. How does intermittent fasting help with this anti-aging autophagy process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think first and foremost that we just understand that a lot of the aging process is a byproduct of dysfunctional mitochondria. So these are the powerhouses of our cells. Mm-hmm. And we know that when we're in an unfed state, our body is able to go in and effectively utilize getting rid of these dysfunctional cells, organelles, et cetera. Even they call it mitophagy. So it's when we go in and autophagy and mitophagy just mean getting rid of things that don't belong. That's really when there's this beautiful process in the body that allows us to get rid of things that could potentially go on to develop certain types of cancers that can contribute to mitochondrial diseases, which if you're north of 40, most of the reason why we're tired, we don't feel as good, we're gaining weight is really related to mitochondrial dysfunction. And so when I think about, you know, this is probably one of the most important benefits, eating less often allows your body to go in and take care of this trash handling, if you will. But when we are, when we eat food, it downregulates that process. So we have to find balance between eating and not eating. It's not suggesting we don't eat. But it's important to understand that sometimes there's value from doing a longer fast. And we know that if you fast long enough, you can impact, you know, the lining of the gut. And if you fast long enough, you can actually stimulate stem cell regeneration and telomere length and all sorts of things that they use as markers of aging. But I think it's important for people to understand that even if you do a 14, a 16, an 18 hour fast, you're still getting benefits. And the longer you fast, the more autophagy you will have. But that's not to suggest it's proper or appropriate for people to do long fasts every day. I do see people, as I'm sure you probably do as well, that think if a little bit of fasting is good, then longer is better. And I remind people, there's a law of diminishing returns over about 24 hours. Mm-hmm. If you're already lean and you're already thin, if you're doing really long fasts, you're at risk for your body can go in and actually catabolize muscle in an effort to keep your body fueled. So I think there's very much a fine line. It's a very individual line. I don't do long fasts anymore for a lot of different reasons, but to me, I don't want to lose muscle mass. And so that's why I'm not doing 36, 72 hour fasts. I did, when I first started doing it, but I don't do that anymore.
Yeah. Talking about sort of like breaking down muscle, that was sort of one of my other questions about exercise. So I feel obviously if you're fasting, you're going to do some cardio or some walking or something gentle. That makes sense to me. You can tap into those fat stores more effectively. But if you're looking to build muscle, weightlift, or even some of this higher intensity exercise, I mean, I know even a lot of, you know, well-muscled people promote fasted workouts still, but sort of my understanding is that surely there's not the fuel available to properly fuel your workout, if you like, and provide that energy, especially if you're someone training for performance, you know, in an athletic setting.
Yeah.
How would it look different in that case?
Well, I think there's a couple of things here. You know, there are researchers like Dr. Stacy Sims is the person that comes to mind. A female athlete is like 0.01% of the population. Very unique skill. I would not recommend fasting. If you're training for an event or an endurance race, I would not integrate fasting into your regimen until you are in recovery mode or you're no longer in that training mode because your body is just using fuel at a different rate. Is the average person an athlete? No. I think it's important for people to understand that, you know, if you're training, the things that impact training and building muscle, obviously life stage is important. So someone at 40 is going to have a harder time building muscle than a 20-year-old. That doesn't mean it's impossible. I think there are a couple things that I think about. You have to hit those protein macros. So no less than 100 grams of protein a day, and ideally 1 gram per pound of ideal body weight. Muscle does multiple things. It helps us with insulin sensitivity. It's the organ of longevity. If you follow Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, as I do.
Oh, I do. I love her.
I just saw her at an event I spoke at. She's a good friend of mine, and we were talking about this. You have to hit your protein macros. You have to lift heavy. It is not body weight exercises and, you know, little itty bitty dumbbells. That's not ideally how you're going to build muscle. And then also thinking, you know, are you sleeping well? Because we know there's so much restorative processes that go on at night. So I think there's multiple things. And then on top of that, what's going on with your hormones? We know testosterone is involved in helping to build and maintain muscle. Women actually have very potent amounts of testosterone until they go through menopause or probably latter stages of perimenopause. There's a lot that goes on. Do I think it's impossible to fast in a fasted state and build muscle? No. I mean, I've been able to do it. I lost 15 pounds in 2019 after being hospitalized for 13 days. I was able to put the muscle back on.
Whilst fasting.
It doesn't. Well, I didn't for the first 3 or 4 months because I was so debilitated. But when I got my clearance, I was back to working out fasted. But I think it's important for people to understand, do a little bit of experimentation. Maybe you fast a couple days a week. You don't have to fast every single day. But if you are metabolically unhealthy, obese, and overweight, you've got plenty of stored fuel that you can utilize in a fasted state. So I think a lot of it has to do with the individual and what they're doing. But if you're already lean and you're already at a goal weight and you're still under the age of 35 and doing a lot of fasting, I would not recommend that.
No, that makes absolute sense. What about caffeine and artificial sweeteners? Because I can't do this fast without a coffee, a black coffee, but a coffee in the morning. It's almost, and again, that could be a habitual or a mental thing, but I need my coffee. But one mistake I think I assume that's okay from what I've read in your book and elsewhere. But one thing I also do is I like my Celsius energy drink or, you know, whatever sort of, you know, it's got the BCAAs in and all the rest of it. But there is some sucralose in there as well, or some kind of sweetener of some kind. Am I undoing the fast by having a little bit of artificial sweetener, and to what extent?
Okay, so good question. I think bitter tea and plain coffee. Plain doesn't mean adding cream or butter or any of those things. I think a clean fast.
Yeah,
there's polyphenols. That's why they are bitter, and this is what people object to. We're very sensitized to sweet things. Those are fine, and I always say the best pre-workout is a, you know, like a cup of coffee or a cup of green tea. So bravo to that. I don't like artificial sweeteners. Sucralose, if you look at the research, actually disrupts the gut microbiome. It does a lot of things in the gut that is pretty detrimental. I think stevia is reasonable, not in a fasted state, of course. It's not part of a clean fast. Yeah. Branched chain amino acids and protein in general will break your fast. So if you're using that after you break your fast, I would just encourage you to find a product that doesn't have sucralose in it. If you're consuming in a fasted state, you're breaking your fast, absolutely.
Is it still more beneficial, though, to have broken your fast with a liquid? Like you're still not having to digest or put your system through the process of breaking down food. Are you still getting some benefits? I'm trying to hold on to my drink.
Well, no.
But are you still getting some benefits?
Yeah, so let me be clear. I'm a realist. Like whether you break your fast with bone broth, which is protein, if you have a clean protein shake, and please read the ingredient list. There's a lot of junk that's out there. Mm. I would just try to avoid junky sweeteners. I think that's fine. It's really what works for your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I have some patients and clients that like to have bone broth or a clean protein shake, and then they eat maybe an hour later. I think that's absolutely fine. What I don't like to see is people that are in the gym thinking they're training fasted, and what they're doing is they're drinking, like here in the United States, like Gatorade is utter garbage, but it has a lot of high fructose corn syrup if it's the normal stuff. And then the other ones have the junky sweeteners. And I just remind people, I actually, there's a really, really amazing fructose researcher here in the States, Dr. Rick Johnson. And so I strongly encourage people to check out his work. Mm. He's wonderful. Like he's the most infectiously positive researcher I think I've ever met. But he talks about what fructose does in our bodies. It's metabolized into fat. It makes us fat. And so the last thing we should be doing is consuming high fructose corn syrup. I don't know if it's as prevalent where you are as it is here in the States, but it's seemingly.
Well, I'm actually in the States. Okay. I'm in Los Angeles. Oh, goodness. So I'm from the UK, but I'm based here in the US as well. And I've noticed the difference since I've moved here. It's,
and
definitely to what I eat.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's because of the seed oils. It's because of high fructose corn syrup. And so I think it's important for people just to understand, like if you do nothing else, read food labels and try to avoid those two substances, seed oils and high fructose corn syrup, and your life will be much better. And when you go to restaurants, ask, like I was just in Austin, and in Austin, most of the restaurants are pretty proactive about sharing that they don't use seed oils. They use avocado oil, coconut oil, et cetera. I live on the East Coast, and it's very hard to find restaurants where I live where they don't use seed oils. So it means that I'm the crazy person that brings my own salad dressing if I want it, and I don't eat fried food, which might make me sound like a wet blanket. But the point of why I'm sharing this is that I think it's important for people to just be aware. That awareness can be really, really powerful. And I just think most people don't realize that the ingredients here in the United States can really make people very unhealthy. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many people, I lived in a very multicultural area. I lived in Washington, D.C. for almost 20 years. Mm. How many of my patients would tell me, oh, when I lived, you name a country, any country in the world, when I lived in X country, I never had a weight problem until I moved here. And I kept saying, it's probably the food that has to be a contributory factor for sure. And I think a lot of people are surprised when they come here. They assume, oh, it's the United States. Yeah. We're going to have great food. Well, we do in some instances, but we also utilize a lot of cheap ingredients that are designed to increase profit margins and don't necessarily benefit our health at all.
It's a whole nother conversation, but it's almost like America is trying to make people unhealthy with, you know, the lack of rules and regulations around this. But I was warned of that before I moved here. So I was sort of in tune with, okay, I'm going to have to work harder to get the better quality of foods that were just sort of naturally in the restaurants or wherever I went. So you saying you bring your salad dressings, I'm that person too. Not necessarily salad dressings, but in other ways, the way I take my own food to a lot of places. Maybe I used to more in the past than I do now, but completely understand that. And I think intermittent fasting isn't, from what I understand, just another, you know, a keto, another diet that's sort of fatty or whatever. Like you said, it's been around for a very long time. And I love that in your book as well, you also give some fantastic recipes and all the rest of it. So just in a nutshell, what and a way of actually doing intermittent fasting, you do a staged approach, don't you, to introduce you to it. So just sort of finally, you know, just tell us a little bit more about the book itself, where obviously people can find it, and more about you as well.
Yeah, thank you. So the book is designed to be the book I wish I had had 8 years ago. It's designed to give some science without being scary and overwhelming. It's designed to educate women about their hormones and their health. It's also designed to walk you through this 45-day plan where we, you know, it's a very graduated plan. So it's not like you start from day one, you're fasting automatically. It's like cleaning out your pantry and educating you about nutrition and doing it in a way where you feel like a good friend is doing it, as opposed to those, you know, relationships that we have with our patients, where sometimes patients feel like they're being spoken down to. It's like a good friend is sitting you down and kind of walking you through the process. I'm a huge proponent of women eating enough animal-based protein. I know that may not resonate with every single person, but I talk about why it's important to make sure you're getting your protein intake, whether it's animal or plant-based. I talk a lot about the right types of fats, the right types of carbs. I'm not anti-carb. I am someone that I carb cycle, for full disclosure, but I would probably lean carnivore-ish. That's probably where my diet plan is. Yeah. And then there are over 50 recipes created by an amazing chef, Beth Lipton, who's also a good friend, that are designed to be able to support your needs throughout the program. And I've gotten a lot of questions from people along the lines of, how do I hit my protein macros? And I always say, eat a larger portion of protein, or get a scale, or just get educated about what 30, 40, 50 grams of protein looks like. It's not as big as you think it is. I promise you. The other thing that I think is really important, there's a lot of resources, a lot of companies that I enjoy working with who I've worked with for a long time that I personally use. I include a lot of resources. And then, you know, in terms of connecting with me, I have two podcasts, one called Intermittent Fasting Podcast that I co-host with Melanie Avalon. And then my other podcast, Everyday Wellness, that I host, where I get to interview the best and the brightest in the health and wellness space. Definitely want to check those out. You can find me across social media. Be forewarned, I can sometimes be snarky on Twitter. I am on Instagram. and I also have a free Facebook group called Intermittent Fasting Lifestyle / my name that you're more than welcome to join. But yeah, I'm really proud of the book. It's the book I wish I had had. And I really wrote it to make the science and the information accessible and to also empower. Like, I cannot tell you how many clinicians have bought the book and are using it to help educate their own patients. So for me to have other healthcare providers super supportive of the book really means a lot. But I'm grateful for the opportunity of connected with you today.
You too, Cynthia. And I've learned so much. And I, you know, from the book to talking to you now as well, I feel even more inspired to, you know, personalize, do this right, and make sure I'm not sort of cheating it in any way, because I think the long-term benefits are way outweigh, if you like, just some of the discomfort of adapting what you're routinely have got used to with snacking and so forth. So thank you so much for your time. I know obviously you had a little procedure this morning. You're sitting there with a little Band-Aid on your head. So appreciate you taking the time for us, and wishing you well with that. Thank you again, Cynthia.
Thanks, likewise.
And thank you for listening to the Health Hack Podcast with myself, Caroline Pierce. Each episode provides a healthy dose of health hacking, so make sure to hit subscribe or follow so you don't miss out. I would be truly grateful if you could rate and review wherever you're listening to help others seeking inspiring stories and health hacks to find us. The Health Hack is an Insanity Podcast production and powered by Lumen. See you next time.